We know that pledge breaks are your least favorite part of listening to NHPR. So we've been trying really hard to eliminate them this month. If we manage it, if you help us manage it, we can eliminate those pledge breaks this month. But we need your help now to make it happen. More of your favorite programs, fewer interruptions when you make a gift now at nhpr.org.
The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. The nutrition labels you see plastered on the sides of food packaging are getting a major overhaul next month, the first in 20 years. First Lady Michelle Obama, who has made fighting obesity a major part of her time in the White House, celebrated the upcoming changes in a press conference last month.
Very soon, you will no longer need a microscope, a calculator, or a degree in nutrition to figure out whether the food you're buying is actually good for our kids. So that's a phenomenal achievement.
Dr. James Hamblin is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes the health column for their monthly magazine. He is less enthused about the new labels, and he joins us now to explain. James, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, why don't you just give us an overview? What is different on the new label?
The biggest change is an enormous number that is the calorie count, which is computed the same way it always has been. It's just presented three times larger. Mrs. Obama's comment about not needing a microscope. So that number is really large. All the other numbers are the same size as they ever were. The main differences in those lines is that there is now a distinction for added sugars, which comes below the total sugars, and that there's some changes in the serving sizes, which are meant to reflect what people actually eat instead of what the food manufacturers would deem to be a serving size. They tend to err on the smaller size, therefore the calorie counts look lower, even though most people might end up eating two or three servings.
Right, so maybe one of those little bags of chips that looks like something you would get right at the grocery store counter and you would eat in one sitting. It used to say two servings, which may have been misleading. Now it's just one.
Yeah, you might say, oh, good, it's only 150 calories, I'll eat it. But then you end up eating two or three servings and not that little.
Right. So let's get back to the big emphasis on the calorie number. Like you said, it's much larger than before. You say that that's misleading. How so?
Well, there are ways in which it can be good, but I think people should also be aware that this is something that has been manipulated by food manufacturers in an attempt to make people believe that you can eat junk food if you just have it in small enough quantities, and that if you just eat a 100-calorie pack of Oreos, that's healthy, or that's fine. And in ways, it is okay, but if you were to compare, say, a 100-calorie pack of Oreos or a little pack of almonds, which has 150 calories, you might think, oh, I should just eat the Oreos. But that wouldn't be as healthy for you.
Right. I could count all my calories, fill up 2,000 calories with just Skittles. I already have a Skittle problem, but I could just eat all Skittles and say, I only had this many calories.
Yeah. And it turns out that would be really difficult to do because of the way that blood sugar would surge when you had the Skittles, and then you would get hypoglycemic, and then you'd want more Skittles. We all know these cycles that happen. And 100 calories just ends up being not equivalent between foods. So it's just something to be aware of when you're looking at what appears to be this one giant number, which is supposed to signal the quality of your food.
Well, speaking of sugars, and you're not alone in this suggestion, I've read a few different pieces that have said that this added sugar requirement is, for one, easily circumvented by food manufacturers, but two, kind of broadly missing the point. Tell me a little bit more.
Well, I think like so many of these numbers, it's just one data point that can be looked at in evaluating food, and it's certainly not perfect. A great example that I think of is orange juice versus cranberry juice. You could have orange juice, which is loaded with sugar, you know, just as much sugar as soda, but would have zero added sugars. All of the sugar is coming from the concentration of oranges. And cranberry juice, where cranberries are not a naturally sweet fruit, so you have to pour a bunch of cane sugar into there or high fructose corn syrup, and that all counts as added sugar. So if you were to compare those two things, the cranberry juice would get a big ding, have a bunch of added sugars, look really bad, but in fact, they should have very similar physiologic effects on your body.
Now, would something like a package of Oreos, in which, you know, obviously all sugar is added sugar, is that line just going to put all the sugar into the next line, the added sugar line?
You know, I haven't seen how that would look, but that seems most logically like the way it would be. Yeah, there's no natural Oreo. And it gets to a point where there are cases where that might be a helpful metric, but in the most part, it doesn't quite matter to our bodies where the source of a sugar molecule is coming from.
I read a few things that sort of point out this argument that, you know, that nutrition labels, the people that are actually spending time reading them and maybe analyzing them, these are the folks that maybe don't have as much a problem in the first place because they're looking to educate themselves. And I do have this feeling that no matter what changes were being made, there would be some folks saying, well, this isn't enough, or that we're focusing on the wrong thing. And I wonder if it sounds like maybe we want these nutrition labels to achieve more than any nutrition label really ever could, and this is sort of a substitute for real policy.
Yes, I think that all sounds very accurate to me. When I critique the nutrition labels, it is with an eye to helping people to make sense of these labels that they'll probably have to live with and deal with for the next couple decades, possibly. But they are necessarily imperfect. They're not going to achieve everything, and they are not a replacement for food policy that would make fresh fruits and vegetables available to people cheaply and easily around the country.
So overall, with these new changes, do you think that this just isn't as good as you'd like to see it, or do you think it is a net gain?
I think that the best argument that I've heard is that we don't have good field testing to know, and that this is a very serious public health measure with a lot of far-reaching consequences, that it would have been nice to have some test trials seeing how this might influence people before it became practically implemented. So it would be pure speculation on my part, but I think I don't expect them to have a major impact on the nation's obesity problem.
Well, James, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. James Hamblin is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes the health column for their monthly magazine and hosts the video series If Our Bodies Could Talk. You'll find a link to his article for The Atlantic, The Number to Avoid on the New Nutrition Labels, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. There are some medical mysteries that seem just as strange today as they did thousands of years ago. For example, Aristotle posed this question that I myself have asked: why does the heat of the sun provoke sneezing? Yes, if you have ever sneezed driving out of a dark tunnel or looking up at a fluorescent light, this is a real thing. It's a phenomenon called photic sneeze reflex, and some 15 to 30% of humans experience it, a bigger population than people with green eyes. To learn more about this mysterious quirk, Virginia Prescott sat down with Brian Resnick, science reporter at Vox.com.
Okay, first the headline. The official acronym for this condition is ACHU.
Yeah.
What does it stand for?
Oh, I'm going to have to look this up right here. Yes, it is the autosomal dominant compelling helio-ophthalmic outburst syndrome. And I probably didn't say some of those words correctly, but I think it was one of the cases where they were really trying to make the acronym work.
Yeah, I think they were stretching for that one. But who can't say achoo? I guess we can say that. Are particular populations more likely to have this achoo reaction than others?
It really hasn't been very well studied. So there's only been a handful of surveys asking if people have this or looking for it. It seems that in one study of American medical students in the 1960s, so this is not representative necessarily of the larger population, found that it was more common among males than females, so about 28% of males, and that, you know, very specific sample, and about 16% of females. It's not as well known if it affects other ethnic groups or racial minorities differently, just because they're just haven't been included in the samples. I think the biggest study was of 500 blood donors in Sweden in the 80s, and that came out of a figure of around 20%.
So is it genetic?
Yeah, it's believed to be genetic. It's believed to be, I believe, a dominant trait. So there's been enough studies where they've been able to see that that it seems like if you have a parent that has it, you are more likely to have it too.
So it is interesting that something that is so common is not so studied or so understood. But you did find some theories, like what?
Yeah, well, I think it was first to just point out that this is, you know, it's something, the first thing I wanted to do was just to find people who have this and talk to them. And they all said this is a quirk of their life. You know, it's not a medical emergency every time they see bright light, but it is kind of funny. Yeah, so it's not really well understood, but it's thought to do, I think the best idea is about how our nerves are set up in the brain or in your skull. So there's this one idea that, like, basically your wires get crossed. You have optic nerves and then you have cranial nerves. So your optic nerves are the ones coming out of your eyes and they're responding to light. And you have cranial nerves that control your facial muscles. And this one theory is that the optic nerve and one of these cranial nerves kind of come in very close contact, which would also explain why this is genetic, because there's something like biological, physiological to it. So the thinking is, so when you see a bright flash of light, these wires get crossed and you see the light and you sneeze at the same time. Another possibility is that it's kind of a trait that's left over from evolution. And by another possibility, this could be just another, this could explain that prior possibility that, you know, for some people, evolution has favored that it's better to sneeze more and maybe in certain conditions that will be advantageous.
So you come crawling out of the cave and then you sneeze?
Yeah, you know, like we have all sorts of variety in life just to, you know, even for conditions that may not have, you know, a direct impact on our survival. Or maybe at one point it did, or it's just good to have a group of people in a society that have a little bit more of a propensity to sneeze. Again, when it comes to like evolutionary theory, you can always, those things are hard to prove and easy to guess at.
I guess it's been little studied because it's not a dangerous medical condition, or is it? Can it be dangerous?
Well, I saw some like letters to editors in journals, so not like full studies, but just more like scientists writing in and making the case that this could be dangerous if you're in a very dark tunnel and you're driving and then you suddenly emerge into light. Like, you know, you can suddenly sneeze. And it's also, I also found a citation in a medical journal about like pilots, or I think the National Guard looked into photic sneezing for a bit to see if it was a hazard for their pilots who might have it. And I think that what they concluded there is just a good pair of sunglasses can help you avoid it.
And as you note, high wire acrobats, not good for them.
Yes, if any of your listeners are high wire acrobat suffering through photic sneezing or the achoo syndrome, I definitely want to tell your story.
I've been aching to sneeze, begging please, pretty please, but I can't get the thing to come out.
Brian Resnick is a science reporter for Vox.com, where he wrote the article Achoo Syndrome, Why Some People Sneeze Every Time They See the Sun. You'll find a link to read his article at wordofmouthradio.org. Extraordinary minds, minds that work differently, can be a burden and a gift. Producer Aubrey Ralph knows this firsthand. Aubrey's own experience with bipolar disorder has made him acutely aware of how minds can shape and distort reality. And he discovered in this next piece that's especially true for people with schizophrenia.
When you're bipolar, you live with two different versions of reality. There's a version everyone else seems to inhabit, and then there's your own mood-altered version. When my mood changes, sometimes drastically, it's like shifting color filters on a camera. The same scene can look dark and gloomy, or way too bright, or somewhere in between. I've learned to try to ignore the shifting colors of emotion and focus on what's real. But there are other conditions that can mess with reality itself, like schizophrenia, which is a thought disorder. Being mentally ill, I sometimes wonder, what would it be like to be schizophrenic?
The way I describe it is like a waking nightmare, where you have all the bizarre images and possible things happening and the utter, utter terror. But with a nightmare, you sit up and open your eyes and it goes away. Not the case with a psychotic episode.
Ellen Sachs is a professor of law, psychology, and psychiatry at the USC Gould School of Law. And she is also schizophrenic. When most people hear schizophrenia, they don't think professor. They think crazy street person. And that stigma and lack of understanding is one of the big obstacles patients face.
Stigma is really, really powerful. There are very few things that can shut down someone's life as quickly as everybody agreeing they don't have one.
That's Ed Irwin. He's also schizophrenic, and we'll hear more from him later. The word schizophrenia is made of the Greek words for split and mind, but it might be more accurate to think of it as a mind shattered, where the boundary between truth and fantasy can blur or dissolve completely. Schizophrenia has many symptoms, but the most dramatic are what are called positive. They're what the illness gives you, and you don't want them. They fall under the term psychosis. Imagine not being able to tell the difference between even the wildest idea and reality. One of Ellen's frequent delusions is that she used to be God. Joking, her husband once asked if she quit or was fired. Psychosis isn't something that's on or off, though. Ellen explained that it's more like a dimmer.
I'll have a transient psychotic thought. I've killed hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts, and I'll just step back and I'll say, Ellen, that's just your illness acting up. Pay it no mind. Further along the spectrum, I have what's called social judgment, which is to say, I'm always aware of what other people will think is crazy, and I don't want to appear as crazy, so I just don't say those things. And if I can't help saying them, I go home and stay away from people. And at the far end, I'm crouching in a corner shaking, and that lasts for weeks. That hasn't happened in a decade.
I'm poison.
Do not betray us.
Things I touch are poison. People I get near.
Probe into your brain.
Probably the most well-known symptoms of schizophrenia are hallucinations, and they can be much more complex than you might imagine. Here's Ed again.
When you get really extreme, the human mind attached to the human body is capable of just about anything.
And anything that can be experienced can be hallucinated, including smells or tastes or worse.
You can have tactile hallucinations. Quite a few people are under the impression they're insects crawling under their skin. Very upsetting.
Ellen told me instead of voices, she has what she calls thought commands, as though the thoughts of strangers are randomly invading her head. Most of us have had a taste of this experience. Maybe you thought you heard someone say your name, or at some point caught a glimpse of someone you couldn't have seen. It may sound strange, but even when we're healthy, our brains create as much reality as they interpret. For most schizophrenics, these symptoms are only severe a fraction of the time, and with practice, can even be ignored. In fact, the positive symptoms aren't what cause the most harm at all. The much more devastating part of the illness are the negative symptoms. These are what schizophrenia takes away from you. Here's University of Wisconsin psychiatrist Ron Diamond.
Negative symptoms are when you lose motivation, you lose spontaneity, you lose creativity, you lose the ability to persist in something whether you want to keep doing it or not. And the loss of being able to motivate and to initiate behavior is often much more disabling than hearing voices or believing things that other people disagree with.
Mental illnesses can weigh you down in so many different ways. There's social pressure to be normal, to pass, but there's also fear about what could happen if you fall short. In rough times, jobs, families, and friends can all fall away, and then there's the possibility of ending up in a mental hospital. Generally, these are not places you want to be. I've avoided that, but many are just one episode away. Schizophrenia is also a lonely illness. Being in the bipolar community, I can hold up a list of heroes who have done amazing things, like Mike Wallace or Ernest Hemingway, but there's no real list like that for schizophrenics. This is in part due to the more debilitating symptoms that can hinder creativity, but also because of the negative public image the illness has. People who are doing well usually don't advertise their schizophrenia and certainly don't make the news.
When you walk up to somebody in the street who's panhandling and looking odd and behaving oddly, you say, oh, this person is psychotic. They must have schizophrenia. But when you go into your dentist, unless he or she has a big S on their chest, you don't realize that person also has schizophrenia. And when you go to the bank and the bank teller is behaving absolutely normally, you don't say, oh, that person has schizophrenia. So what we get reinforced with is all of the people who are doing most poorly and most symptomatically who are behaving oddly. And what we miss are all the people with this illness who, through sometimes significant struggle, are behaving pretty normally, fulfilling role functions, living their lives as best they can, with an illness that often makes that much more difficult.
So when you think about schizophrenia and other mental illnesses, please don't linger on the few who do make the news for doing terrible things. Think of the millions out there who we pass every day and don't even know it. They're people just like you, trying to live their lives, whose minds just happen to carry a little extra weight.
That piece was produced by Aubrey Ralph for Wisconsin Public Radio and the PRI show To the Best of Our Knowledge. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In 1991, Nirvana released their second studio album, Nevermind. It was a huge hit and is now considered one of the greatest rock albums of all time, so much so that I didn't bother checking Rolling Stone's all-time greatest albums list. It's there. Back when it came out, rock music magazine Spin didn't honor Nevermind with Greatest Album of the Year. That distinction went to Bandwagon-esque by Teenage Fan Club. Chuck Klosterman was a writer for Spin back then. Today, he is a pop culture critic and author of fiction and nonfiction books like Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs and I Wear the Black Hat. In his newest, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past, Klosterman tries to reverse engineer our view of history and apply it to today. He asks questions like, what song will define the rock genre 1,000 years from now? Who is the great undiscovered writer of the internet age? And is democratic freedom really all it's cracked up to be? It's a great read, and Chuck, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here. I gotta say, though, I wasn't at Spin yet when Nevermind came out.
I was still
a college student. That article did prompt me to buy Bandwagon-esque, which is a great record. Although if you're a member of Teenage Fan Club, you gotta kind of hate the fact that the main thing you're remembered for is being number one on a list no one believes.
Yeah, I have to admit, I had actually never heard of the band until I was reading your book.
Oh, really? Well, they're great. Yeah.
Does it alarm you maybe how misguided we are often when we're thinking about, you know, music or film or any of these things?
You know, it doesn't alarm me. I don't find it to be an alarming thing. I just find it to be an interesting thing. I mean, you know, in the present tense, we sort of view the world through the criteria we use for our sort of temporary measurement of greatness or importance. And it's a really fluid thing. It can change from like moment to moment. And then, of course, as time moves on, the history of ideas is basically the history of wrongness. And we look back at periods of time and we go, well, boy, they thought this at the time, but the real answer, of course, was X. And what I'm trying to do in this book is try to figure out what X is going to be, even if we can't see it now.
Right. So you come up with this principle, Klosterman's razor. Can you explain what that is?
Well, okay, if you talk to a policeman or a lawyer or a journalist about any kind of problem that isn't clear, that has no obvious solution, they will often say, well, you know, you look at Occam's razor. The clearest, most obvious response is the best response.
Yeah, the simplest.
Yes. But my philosophy is different. My philosophy is that when you look at a problem, the first thing you have to do is assume that your reflexive answer is wrong. That wrongness is built in to whatever you believe because everything about the past indicates that this is reality. That in all likelihood, the way we think about the world in the future will be a totally different paradigm than how we think about it now. So, of course, our conclusions will be totally different.
Yeah, so you apply this to music and literature and a number of things. You point out how many of our greatest writers weren't well known until years after they died. Herman Melville, for example, wasn't nearly as important in his own time as he is to us now. So how can you reverse engineer a process where, say, the next great American writer is maybe somebody we don't know at all?
Well, the short answer is it's impossible, and it's just kind of an interesting thing to do. But once you make the decision you're going to try it, this is what I did. I would pretty much go through people from the past that have emerged as meaningful. And I think to myself, what was the reasoning or the rationale we used when we look at history? And let's take those qualities, even if they seem a little awkward and unwieldy, and apply them to now. So, like you mentioned Herman Melville. There was a guy who, he was a commercially successful writer, just in the way that a lot of guys write books and make a living doing so and don't seem to have any meaning outside of themselves at the time they're doing it.
Right. He wasn't the great American novelist. He was just, an American novelist.
He was an American novelist, and he wrote Moby Dick thinking it would be his masterwork. And it got mixed reviews and didn't sell that great, kind of ruined his life. He became an alcoholic and he died. Mm-hmm. And then it was after World War I, years later, that the book was sort of reevaluated as not just, a good book, but like the book, okay? So that's one case. Another possibility is like somebody like Franz Kafka, who was essentially unknown entirely. He had some confidants and there was a small circle of writers who knew him. But for the most part, he was an unknown person. And the fact that he was unknown really buoys his importance now because people can sort of project whatever they want onto him. He was like a clean slate. His work within his lifetime did not have any specific context.
Right.
So future people can create the context. So I started thinking, okay, well, this means that the greatest writer from this generation will be one of three candidates. It'll be someone who we think will be that person, who we already project to be that person, John Franzen or whatever, even though history says that never happens almost.
Hmm.
Or it'll be somebody who we know about but don't think of as important or who we don't know at all. And then the last two categories are sort of what I kind of speculate about and try to anticipate.
That's a tough job. It kind of makes me think of the musical Hamilton. We're in Word of Mouth. We're all big fans lately. And it makes me think of how he's being reframed as a much more important figure historically than he was even maybe, 5-10 years ago. And how you cannot predict how the society or culture or some person will change the way we think about, something from the past.
Okay. Well, just imagine this. Imagine it's 1965 and you tell someone, you know what? We're going to change our currency. For one thing, we're going to put Harriet Tubman on a bill. And they would be like, what are you talking about? And then you go on further to say, for a while we thought we'd replace Alexander Hamilton. But we're not going to do that because he's going to be the center of a real popular musical. just how crazy that seems. This is exactly what has happened, of course. But just this idea that a musical could impact how people will view money for hundreds of years in all probability is amazing. But that is the arbitrary nature of history. And, in many ways, I'm a critic, right? That's the main thing I do. I write novels and I write features, but I'm mainly a critic, And as a critic, of course, you're consumed with the idea of merit and what gives something merit.
Right. This is your job. You're assigning value.
Yes. And yet that is really only true in the present. In the present tense, we can live in this logical world kind of inside our own skulls. And we can say to ourselves let's measure the merit of object A against object B. But history doesn't work that way. History works in these strange sort of seemingly arbitrary, nonsensical ways that are also then jammed in to a logical framework. So in the future, when we talk about Hamilton having this impact on whose image is on currency, what we will probably say is not, it's so crazy a musical did this. We will say, there was a musical about Hamilton around the same time that ideas like Black Lives Matter and identity politics was real central to the cultural discourse. And, the entry of Harriet Tubman into the face of a bill had to do both with her being a woman and her being African-American. And Hamilton, maybe we'll add some other thing that's not even going on. There was a realization that Hamilton had such an impact on how the treasury is created. It seemed like a paradox to remove him from this because so much of the way the treasury works is because of Hamilton's ideology. That's not really part of the conversation now, but it might be in the conversation in 100 years when people try to explain this in a way that isn't nuts.
Right. we'll justify it. We'll find a way.
Yes.
Yeah. How will history remember 2016 in 500 years? Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. I'm speaking with pop culture critic Chuck Klosterman about his new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. So your book doesn't just deal with the arts. You also talk about what we may be getting wrong about science, about existence as we know it. And in fact, you got a chance to speak with the superstar astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who you said was mildly annoyed by your questions.
He was. It was, and I don't want to overstate this. It wasn't like he yelled at me, but there was a slight adversarial tone to our interaction. And I think I know why. I mean, he's kind of become the face of mainstream science, right? So he is the person who is always in these debates about climate change. Is climate change real? And I think – I wonder if he thought, well, here's some guy coming in saying he's doing a book about, you know, collective wrongness. Is he just trying to disprove these things that his whole life is built on? If you ask the average person, do you think that the way we view a lot of the realities of science will be totally different in 500 years without giving them any specifics, they'll almost always say, you know, probably, you know, that seems reasonable. But you say that to a scientist, in a way, you are attacking his or her vocation.
Right.
You're suggesting that they're just kind of spinning their wheels and eating up time before we get to the real answer, which no one knows. I think there was a little of that in his response. You know, I talked to Brian Greene, who's another like high profile, like rock star, you know, physicist or whatever. And his take was, this is fun. Let's do it. You know, this is goofy.
Yeah. It's funny. Neil deGrasse Tyson was a little dubious of your premise. But then later, you know, he acknowledges this idea, which is totally crazy to most people, that we may be living in a super sophisticated simulation. He basically says, OK, well, that's not totally off the table. So, you know, he really does kind of come around to this idea that maybe we are wrong. He just doesn't want to totally put
it out there. Well, you know, the idea of all reality being a computer simulation, you know, that we're actually like basically all characters in the highest level version of The Sims that could exist,
right,
and that somebody in the year 3600 has created a game that replicates civilization and we're like the little pieces in that game. The reason this seemingly absurd, almost unfathomable suggestion is often sort of supported by scientists is because mathematically, the odds that we're a simulation are actually higher than the odds that this is real. And when you start bringing math into the equation, it's very difficult for a scientist to dismiss it out of hand, because now science and math have this interlocked relationship, which was not the case until about the 1600s.
So you cover science, you cover the arts, you cover politics in a big way, in a sort of a very broad way. But I was wondering if you were tempted to apply the sort of thinking in this book to the 2016 presidential election.
Makes that complicated, okay? The premise of the book sort of is like, what are things that seem so natural and true to us that we don't even view them as questions, that we just sort of accept them as things that really aren't up for debate? So if you put it in the context of this election, that would be this idea that Donald Trump is a travesty and this is proof of the electoral process collapsing, or at least the GOP collapsing, which really maybe started with Sarah Palin's anointment as a VP candidate, you know, and this is the logical extension. So if we're really wrong about this, it would mean our view of Trump and the future of the Republican Party is actually going to be the opposite, that somehow Trump's emergence is the rational reaction to the way society is, and the move that the Republican Party has made ideologically is sort of a sensible, natural move. And in the present tense, that seems impossible. Like if we had a bunch of political pundits, you know, sitting here with us talking on the radio, it would be impossible for them to even put that in sort of a dialogue that would be like, well, okay, this might be what's going on. But now in 300 years, I guess, if we're really wrong about this, people will think about it differently because they'll have the benefit of seeing how the world unspools.
Right.
They also won't have the sort of day-to-day interaction with these candidates that we have. I mean, you know, right now, like the conventional wisdom is that the worst president of all time is James Buchanan. Okay, when I went to college, it was Grant, but that has changed. Grant's now like only the seventh worst president according to historians. Buchanan is the worst president. But What was Buchanan like? You know, how did he seem to the people he talked to? Like, you can read people's depiction of it, but we really don't know. This is an interesting thing about how Ronald Reagan will be perceived as we move further and further away from the 80s. And we'll get to a point where only a sliver of the populace will really remember his presidency. And as a consequence, they will forget a lot of the reasons of why Reagan was so popular. He somehow gave the sense that the 1980s were prosperous even if you were poor, you know, and all of these things that were not part of his content, but sort of just part of the way he presented the information. And as we move away from the 80s and people die off and new people emerge, we'll only be going by the content, and that will maybe change how we view him, you know? I mean, right now, there are people who would like to see Reagan, you know, on Mount Rushmore. I mean, there was a national poll where a large chunk of the populace said that. It would be difficult to imagine that in 50 years.
So yeah. What do you think, given all that you've done with this book, that your work, that this piece stands a chance of being remembered, you know, thousands, hundreds of years from now?
I would say almost none. I would say the only way would be is if some unusually specific prediction I make in the book, and I don't make a ton of predictions in this book, if one of the more dramatic ones proved to be accurate and it was somehow realized that I was the first person to pose this, I suppose then the book would have some kind of different life in 350 years. But then again, it really wouldn't be me. It would be that specific detail. It wouldn't be like they would go back and re-examine the entire book. I mean, I will be known as long as I keep putting books out. And when I stop putting books out, I will be unknown.
Well, we'll keep having you back as long as you do. So, Chuck, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks.
Chuck Klosterman, pop culture critic and author of the new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. In the 1990s, virtual reality was a gimmick, clunky and not very realistic. But today, with the rise of Oculus Rift and other VR headsets, it's pretty darn convincing. That sound comes from a YouTube video where a young woman wearing a virtual reality headset is more or less freaking out while playing a zombie survival game. And after she's done, she takes off the headset, wipes away a tear, and raises a hand to show just how badly she's shaking. For some folks, this immersive experience is part of the thrill. It's just a simulation, after all. But there is no denying that virtual reality can have a powerful effect on our emotions and our bodies. At Be Another Lab, researchers have been running experiments on how virtual reality could be used to make people more empathetic. Imagine, for example, looking down at your hands and seeing a different skin color, or stepping momentarily into the body of the opposite gender. Others have pointed towards its use as a type of therapy for folks suffering from PTSD. But the folks at Be Another Lab also warn that virtual reality might just as easily be used to inflict anguish. Marte Royal is a lecturer and researcher at Be Another Lab, and he joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
You've seen the powerful possibilities of virtual reality up close. Why do you think it has such a powerful impact on people?
I think it's sensory capabilities. It's very powerful. It's probably the closest we have gotten to replicating reality.
Yeah, there's some of these videos I was talking about where you know see somebody playing a zombie game. You know, I've watched people where they start losing their physical ability to control the controllers. You know, they're ready to throw the headset off their bodies. It really seems like their brains are being tricked and they know it.
Yeah, definitely. And there's also a sensory deprivation component where you're completely immersed in this other reality, which is not completely free in a way as we are used to the freedom that we have of our body and senses in actual reality. So that's also another aspect that could potentially account for this.
So what did your empathy experiments look like at Be Another Lab? What were the sorts of things that you were doing and discovering?
Well, I think there's a very basic idea of stepping into the shoes of someone else, which really comes naturally from virtual reality. And what we did different than others was to work with actual people that have a real story. And not only that, but work in real time, so you are able to step into the shoes of someone else that is situated on the same location as you are. And you can start a conversation from there with that other person. So basically stepping into the shoes of anyone that has a different identity from you could potentially open space for empathy and dialogue.
So the flip side to the research that you've done is this idea that virtual reality technology has real impacts on conditions like chronic pain and PTSD, but that it could also have negative impacts with those same ideas. You know, we could maybe inflict pain or create traumatic experiences. Is this the sort of thing that you had a realization about as a group, you know, a moment where you thought, ooh, what if somebody is doing the same things that we are but coming to a very different set of conclusions?
Definitely. I think we were very naive when we started the project. We really wanted to create a better world, I mean. And by doing this system that could grow exponentially, we thought that we would make exponential change in humanity. And we, of course, realized at some point that it wasn't as pretty as it looked. We realized this partly by attending many VR events in the world, where the discussion centered on the industry. And by realizing that most of the industry has developed with military funding and still is. And we wondered why would military be interested on this. And one of the reasons, of course, on our particular application would be to potentially de-empathize communities. So how do you make sure that people don't have any feelings towards the other?
Do we have a sense that even though it is a simulated experience, a person wearing a virtual reality headset might experience some type of quote-unquote real pain?
I mean, what is real pain? I'm not very sure, but psychological pain, of course. And I think that can be felt very physical. You can only imagine the worst things that could happen to you or your family and experience them in a very immersive way. And I cannot imagine any bigger pain than that.
Are you concerned that the technology is moving faster than the conversation?
Yes, definitely. I think we are the non-expert community is very naive. But I do think that we should have a more mature conversation on VR and on technology as well in general. Technology doesn't grow in a vacuum. No, technology is born in this system of exploitation, and most of the technological advances of the past century have been from military technology and still are. So in that sense, I think we should be very careful about our consumption and our ideas and our focus. Of course, many of the VR applications that are coming out are games, and many of the games are, I mean, this has been in the public conversation for years, maybe decades. Many of them are first-person shooters, and that's, in a way, very related to the conversation that we are having.
Given that, what are you working on at Be Another Lab now? I mean, you've had this realization, you've spoken about it publicly, but obviously you're going to keep doing what you're doing, right?
Yeah, we are, and we are focusing on social applications, anything from work with refugees to work with children in marginalized communities. But one of the things that we aim to do, and we haven't found the space or the proper collaborations to do so, is to develop a license that is a plugin to the Creative Commons license, which is a commonly used license on mostly on technologies. So the license that we're looking at is a culture of peace only license, so that whatever developments that we do can be applied by anyone as long as it is applied for promoting a culture of peace. It's, of course, a philosophical matter and an ethical matter, what is a culture of peace, but right. That's one of the things that we would like to develop.
Well, Marte, thank you so much for speaking with me about this.
Sure.
Marte Royal is a researcher with Be Another Lab, a group that's been experimenting with virtual reality. You can learn more about their work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for listening to the show today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio and on Twitter at wordofmouth. And we've got a podcast too. You probably knew that already, but if you don't, give it a download. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.